Minnesota Court of Appeals. The final oral case on our calendar today is A21-0896. Kimberly Rose Wangsness on behalf of minor children versus Brian Penkert. We are conducting our oral argument by Zoom today. I thank counsel for your patience. We've had some technology issues. There is only one party arguing today. You will have 15 minutes for your argument, and we ask that you please identify yourself and the party you represent when you start your argument, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. Attorney Jacob Burkholz representing appellant and underlying respondent Brian Penkert on the issuance of an order for protection. Where to start? I like to not regurgitate the record, but focus on the issues in this case. There's a relatively short transcript in the scheme of things. I'm sure you see about 60 some pages from a single isolated order for protection hearing. The hearing itself contained testimony of two parties, Ms. Wangsness and Mr. Penkert. And that's really the totality of the evidence the court has to review. And there are two children subject to the order for protection. And as such, I'll try to refer to them as CP, the female child, and GP, the male child. The court, we did a motion for amended findings, which I hope the court can appreciate because the original order just has a check the box and really didn't get anything from the district court. But the district court's analysis, which is referenced in my brief, kind of highlights the problematic review of the record before you. Kind of want to start with what's the law. And it's my belief that this court would have to find that the district court found or the record supports that Mr. Penkert had the present intention to commit harm or threaten to commit harm on either child to affirm under Minnesota Statute 518B.01. I think that's supported by case law, some of which I've referenced is the Jurgum case, if I say that right, 392 Northwest 2nd 604, Court of Appeals 1986 published case, and the Chosa v. Tagliente case, 693 Northwest 2nd 487 2005 published case. Those cases stand for the proposition, very rarely do respondents win on appeal, so we have a very limited selection of cases of which to argue from for the respondent, but they do stand for the proposition that there has to be district court support in the record to make the findings. So where should we start? Again, with GP, I think that's, well, let me start with the easier one. I think it's easier. CP, the female child, which is, I think, second in my argument. The district court, the facts are extremely limited, and I want to kind of state the negative first, which is Ms. Wangsness admitted Mr. Penkert very clearly on cross-examination, very clear answers, very clear questions. Of course, I was the district court attorney. And she admitted there was no striking or harm with CP by Mr. Penkert or threats of harm to her. So there isn't any of it. So what did the district court do? The district court then states there's this sexual offense that is committed. And the district court then says that the sexual offense is essentially the lewd exhibition of the genitals and then bootstraps in the statute on the amended findings of the sexual offense statute for that offense. So what are the facts that the district court attempted to use to support that? And I want to be very clear, they're exceptionally limited in the record, so it should be fairly easy to follow, but that the allegation, and again, taken as if true, I understand that I have a steep burden if I'm going to say the district court is wrong, but let's assume the transcript is correct and Ms. Wangsness, even accepted as true, stated a singular fact, which is, and it's, again, very limited, which is that Mr. Penkert at times slept naked and she saw him have an erection. The child, and this is very important, seemed awake. Well, not only I did make hearsay objections all through the case, I made them in my motions, that's in there, but obviously a party can't claim they know what another person saw. But she does not say the child was awake, and she does not say that the child saw Mr. Pinkert. So that's the first layer of problems to even get to the argument that the district court is correct. So the child didn't see anything. It was hearsay to suggest by the district court that the child saw something. Of course, the district court didn't even make that finding in its own ruling. But the court seems to suggest in a very kind of, I can appreciate his paternalistic response, that there's this kind of bootstrapping logic that the court makes on a variety of circumstantial bases in order to get to its very tenuous and unsupported factual conclusion, which is essentially that Mr. Pinkert was engaged in lewd exhibition of his genitals in front of CP.
Merkles, why on this issue, if we, for the sake of argument, if we assume that your client was naked and was naked erect and the child and CP was awake, why isn't that enough to sustain this OFP under Stevenson?
Certainly, because lewd, well, there's a couple layers to this. Number one, I think it goes without saying that this is his own bedroom in his own private space, and the district court acknowledges this. Secondly, that because it's not in a public space, the court can't make a suggestion that this is done with any sort of ill intent or circumstantial intent, that an erection, sleeping in your own room or being in your own room, is a natural biological process. There is not the suggestion of masturbation. There's not a statement or even hint that this was that, or that he was doing anything sexual.
Excuse me. And
yes.
Wasn't the testimony of that she smells sex? And if the district court gave that credibility, wouldn't that support that finding?
Well, she did say it generally smelled like sex. True. But that, I don't think that supports the finding, because it's their own bedroom. And if you look at the testimony of herself, there's no suggestion that it's linked to the child. And so I, again, it's that dangerous.
Well, doesn't it link it to the child where he has an erection and it seems unusual? You know, the standard is preponderance of the evidence. And if the district court finds credibility in that, how do we overturn that?
Well, you start with the elements of the statute, right? We have to start with the statute and work your way backwards. We can't just simply say that he was naked and had an erection, therefore. But I agree, if you assume that he is naked and has an erection in his own bed, and he's coming up from the covers, there's a couple of very clear distinctions why that factually. The child was always slept on the floor, and we have that evidence in the record, on a mattress below the bed. And so there isn't anything in the record to suggest the child was in the bed with him. She did not say that. And so there isn't this kind of circumstantial argument that, and even the district court doesn't say that. Well, she might have been in the room. The district court doesn't say she was in the bed, doesn't say she saw anything, doesn't say there was anything sexual happening, doesn't say that there was a sexual act that occurred, doesn't even link any of that together, just says it's just inappropriate. That's the way I would best categorize the judge's findings, but that's not what the statute says. So I understand that, you know, the Court of Appeals must look favorably on every sort of finding, but that's just, and what does the district court actually say? Being in bed naked, I'm quoting page 6, addendum page 12. Being in bed naked with an erection with 1 7-year-old daughter is alarming. It doesn't even actually link the statute at all, and it just shows the district court's belief that this just isn't okay. I would point out the child, there's no evidence the child was in the bed with him. And so the judge is kind of making these assumptions that aren't supported by the facts or the testimony, again, to make it more of a shock value for you to uphold. But I ask that this court look back to the testimony first, make the findings, because this court knows that it's clear error to make a finding that doesn't exist in the record. So that's the first argument. And secondly, even if once the court looks at those facts, it cannot support the statute. So then the court, again, doesn't quote any of the statutory language by the sexual conduct statute or the order for protection statute, and then just says, again, following that on page 6 in the addendum in that court order of the amended findings says, standing openly in the presence of a child cannot in any way be explained. That, again, has no reference to any statutory authority, any legal authority that would support a 518B.01 criminal sexual conduct.
Let's assume this scenario. Your client sent a picture of his erect penis to this child. Would that constitute lewd exhibition of his genitals in violation of the criminal sexual conduct statute?
Possibly.
Okay. What's the difference between sending a picture and just being in bed, with your erect penis and the child seeing it? I don't see the distinction.
Ah, because many of those facts are not in the record, first of all. So number one, the child didn't see it, didn't say she was in a vantage point to see it. And most importantly, the intent of the party has to be in the record. Very clearly, Your Honor made a great suggestion. Mr. Pinkert's intent would be utterly clear by taking the picture of himself and then sending it. In this case, we don't have that in the record. We don't have any circumstantial evidence to infer the intent of Mr. Pinkert to just generally be naked. It actually suggests, the opposite, that she walks into the room and he comes out from the bed. So he's actually in a privacy mode and then comes out of bed. So this isn't a situation where he sees him with the child naked to make an inference that he was doing something to show the child his genitalia. I would agree it would be a great analogy.
So what case or statute are you relying on to suggest that intent is a requirement for fifth degree criminal sexual conduct?
Sure, I think that's in my... I know we did reference the Stevenson case. State versus Austin, 788 Northwest 2nd, 788. State versus Vic.
Didn't Austin involve second degree criminal sexual conduct, and that's not what's at issue here?
True, but I think you're right. And so it is not a direct correlation. We understand that. But the intent of the criminal sexual conduct statutes, which are all referenced, show that there has to be some sort of sexual or aggressive intent that occurred. I think you can't have accidental exposure and have lewd exhibition of your genitals. I think that's contrary to the plain language, which is perhaps maybe where the court's going, that if I was in the shower naked, my child walked in the room, I came out and had an erection, I was in the bathroom, whatever, and the child saw it, which would be akin to the facts here. I certainly hope that the court wouldn't read that to be that accidental exposure meets criminal sexual contact.
I think it does say where you know or have reason to believe that minor is present. I think that's the language of the statute.
Yeah, a couple layers to that though, but you also have to have the lewd exhibition and
right. Right.
So if having an erection, being naked does not by in and of itself mean that there's a lewd exhibition. Or again, Stevenson, I think the guy was masturbating undisputedly in his car where there was bystanders walking by and there were very clear exposure. And obviously he lost that case. And then there was a walkway in front. So it was a kind of a public space. He's in his truck, but the court says, if there's a vantage point, this again is your own private bedroom. You can't get more private. He's under the covers. And the child, again, it would be hearsay to argue what she saw. And then she says, she seemed awake. I can't be more critical that it is an unknown fact that the child did in fact see anything. And that's quoted right from her. And the district court seems to glance over that. It's not clear she's awake. It's not clear she had vantage point. It's not clear that she did see anything on top of the dilemma that there's no circumstantial evidence to support that argument.
Does the testimony about their past sleeping arrangements factor in at all in the, the analysis here?
It does to support, I suppose, the argument that there was a lack of, that the mother did not have a concern that they may be exposed accidentally. I guess that's the way I'd argue it in favor of my client, that having the children in a room in which you may be changing and exposing yourself did not have any concern to her. and having the children on their beds, in their marital beds, in which presumably they had sexual relations consensually. Again, I don't want to go too far outside the record, would show that there is a lack of concern or lack of circumstantial evidence to support an inference of intent to expose oneself sexually. But I would reiterate, they're on beds below their bed, I think on separate beds.
So Mr. Burkholz, can you turn to the other child now and the,
yes,
the court's findings relating to the other child, and we'll give you some additional time.
I thought I'd grab the easy one first, apparently not. The GP. So try not to get caught up too much in the facts, because I think they're misreferenced, meaning there is a February 10th and I think a July incident. Then the 16th is actually an error on the part of Ms. Wangsness. But February 10th, she doesn't see anything. And then in July, she says she saw something. And what does she see? The issue there is there's no dispute that he's restraining the child that's rambunctious, wild, jumps off the couch, in her own words, and Ms. Pinkert's testimony is consistent, tackles him, grabs him around the head, and he restrains the child and holds him down, and she doesn't like it. But that's really the sum and substance. Again, the 10th, she doesn't actually see the incident. She says sometime in July. Again, this is back in 2018, February of 2018. And then in July, it's kind of undetermined if this is a July of 2018 or last July. But in any event, there are very similar incidents, none of which, and it's important to note, she doesn't ever say he hit or struck. Because I asked that question and then she says yes. But when I identify the details, she very clearly says, no, he never hit or struck the child. He never threatened to commit harm to the child. So that's pretty replete in the record. And she describes those appear to be two consistent episodes where Mr. Pinkert is, again.
Didn't she also testify after she said, and I'm looking at page 31 of the transcript. No, because he didn't hit or strike. He banged the back of his head on the floor. Mm-hmm. And then elsewhere, I thought she testified that that happened 2 to 4, 3 to 4 times. So, and the district court found her testimony to be credible. So why? How did the district court clearly err in its findings regarding the assault to the male child?
Right, and I'm gonna start with the technical answer, which is he never made a finding that the actual commit of domestic abuse. He does make the finding she's more credible, but the judge never makes an actual finding that he had the present intent to or committed harm or committed the present act to commit harm or threatened the child. So the judge just never actually, he checks the box, but when in his amended findings, the court kind of goes again back through this long belabored analysis of, well, maybe he's got a heavier hand in discipline. The child might've been afraid, but those are not the statutory requirements. This court can't affirm that the child, again, I argued hearsay, but was afraid, or that the child bumped his head. Children obviously bump their head all the time. The judge then says she's more credible that the child bumped his head or that my client restrained the child. But that's not the statutory requirement. Even if she's found credible, that doesn't meet the statutory definition. And the judge did not make the statutory definition finding. So we could, if this court's concerned, we can do a reverse and remand. But I had that happen in at least one case that was unpublished. But that this reverse and remand, that the court can't regurgitate facts back. And it's the clamor. It's an unpublished case. It's my case. The court reversed and remanded because reciting evidence is not a finding under the law to support a fact. I think that's all it stands for. And I think that's pretty clear law. But that's what the judge does here. Reportedly slammed the child on the ground. Again, that's not what she said, that she heard the noise and it heard his head bump. But what's important is she didn't, when I asked her, she didn't say he had struck or hit the child, just that his head hit a wood floor. But regurgitating that evidence or that statement, the judge in his last, one of his last, page 8, addendum 14, says that, and makes, tries to make this connection that when I make the reasonable force argument, says, well, slamming a child's head on the floor multiple times is neither restraint nor correction. So there seems to be this, the court's making this bootstrapping argument that if you hear a bump, then Mr. Pinkert must have intended to hurt the child. That's not the testimony. That's not her testimony or Mr. Pinkert's testimony, nor does the district court say Mr. Pinkert intended to harm the child or that he actually harmed the child. That's not anywhere in the court's finding or in the record, just that he bumps his head and straddles and pins him down and in an effort to restrain him. The court then makes a negative finding that it's not restraint. And I want to be clear on my legal argument that the failure to make a finding on 60906, meaning that it was not reasonable force, does not make the reverse finding, which is that there was the present intent to commit harm. Just because it wasn't quote unquote reasonable doesn't mean the reverse, that it was actually domestic abuse. Then it just falls into the gray area of conduct that doesn't meet the statute, but conduct that the court didn't clearly endorse as proper parenting. And maybe that's what we have here is Ms. Wongsness is very much on the other side. Don't discipline your child whatsoever, because I asked her replete questions of this child bites and this happens a lot and he has to restrain the child. And that happened between the two of them as part of their parenting time. And that's why there's this suggestion of, well, she doesn't like it if I use a quote unquote heavier hand. Mr. Pinkert doesn't admit using a heavier hand, but that is what Ms. Wongsness believes. But a heavier hand on discipline of parenting growing up of that style doesn't mean there's domestic abuse. Restraining a child physically, we've all seen it in a grocery store, a parking lot, grabbing their arm, pulling them, grabbing them, picking them up, is not domestic abuse, where the parent is engaging in an effort to restrain the child who undisputedly was jumping in and over the top of my client's head from the chair as he was stroking the other child's hair. Clearly not a situation that was discipline. It was not a situation of harm. The child was not stated to be harmed. And so this is a situation where even though the court says she's credible, the court cannot make the findings of domestic abuse as the court didn't make them. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right, well, thank you, Mr. Burkholz, for your argument today. We will carefully consider the case and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.